Hello, and welcome to the Flabby Bottom Flying Club Studios and the EAA Chapter 84 podcast. I'm your host, David Weber, and in this episode, we will sit down for a conversation with a man of many talents and an incredible history of aircraft design, Bob McDonald. In our conversation with Bob, we discuss his education at MIT, along with his early career as an aerodynamist for Hiller Helicopter and the X-18 Tilt Wing program. Bob shares with us his idea of designing and building the S-10, which eventually leads to the S-20, an airplane he built and flew for many years. Bob continued to make improvements to the S-20, all the while being part of a design team of such notable aircraft like the Lear Fan, Gulfstream, and the B-2 Bomber. The interview wraps up with Bob explaining why, as an aeronautical engineer, he has a passion for safe aircraft design, his advice on how to achieve it, and a program he has developed to promote it. I found this interview to be one of the most educational interviews I have done. Later, I will touch on some Chapter 84 news, an Oshkosh 2021 update, and a tribute to one of my personal heroes. And now, after a quick word from our sponsor, I will bring you chapter member Bob McDonald. Welcome to the Flabby Bottom Flying Club Studios. I'm your host, David Weber, and with me today, I have got the privilege of interviewing Bob McDonald. Bob has been a member of EAA Chapter 84 for some time now, and I'd like to welcome him to the studios. Thanks for coming down here, Bob.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Glad to have you. Let's start this interview by, like most interviews, kind of going back to the beginning and kind of tell the audience where you grew up and what piqued your interest when you were growing up in aviation.
Well, David, I grew up, the biggest thing going on in my youth was World War II. And I was eight when it began. I was 11 and a half when it ended. As a result of dislocations due to the war and family, I lived all over the place. I lived, born in Denver, lived in Pueblo, Colorado, lived in Vernon, Texas, lived in Claremont, New Hampshire, lived in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. This was all before going to Boulder for high school. Graduated at 52 in Boulder High School.
So was there any sort of building or engineering?
Well, my father was an engineer with the Army Air Forces and involved in airport, air base construction. So he would be sent to where an air base was being built.
And that would explain why you were hopping around all these different areas.
Yeah.
Now, during high school, did you get involved in any aviation?
Just the model building. Just the model building that I used to do as a kid and continued up and through high school.
So were these flying models?
Yeah. Flying scale mostly. I did have a one gas powered model at which I lost.
Didn't we all?
So that was kind of the end of that. But,
so after high school, you've got this interest in aviation.
Sure.
Peaked on by World War II.
Yes. And building models and, admiring people who flew airplanes and wanting to do it. My eyes were not of a quality that would let me be a military pilot, so I had to forego that.
Did your dad, your parents, your family, did they know that you had this interest in aviation, and did they support that interest?
Oh, yeah, they supported it. They couldn't avoid it since I was always involved in the model building and flying. But I didn't have anyone in the family who was, you know, themselves involved in aviation.
So dad wasn't a pilot, no uncles, nothing along those lines. Where was your first exposure to actually a full-scale airplane?
Well, I'd seen them flying overhead. I saw in Pueblo, Colorado, I'd see B-17s, whole formations of B-17s flying overhead, which... was pretty had to be pretty impressive. My first airplane ride was in a DC-3 when I was a little bit older, about 14 or so, moving from Lancaster to Boulder.
So that was a commercial flight?
That was a commercial flight, yeah.
Did you get to go up and see the cockpit at that time?
No.
Unfortunately.
No, for not. Well, there wasn't any rules against it, but just didn't.
If you could turn back time, right?
Yeah.
Have you been in a DC-3 since?
No, I'm afraid not. Afraid not.
Oh, that's a shame. There's a few still flying around.
I suppose so, sure.
Be a great flight to go in that. After high school, like a lot of kids, you end up going off to college. And kind of tell us where that college was and what piqued your interest in going to college.
Well, as I said, I was in Boulder, which is the seat of the University of Colorado.
Okay.
Has a perfectly good aeronautical engineering department. My mother was a teacher in Louisville, which is a suburb of Denver. I asked her, I told her I wanted to be an aeronautical engineer and where was the best place to go. She said, I'll get back to you. She went to the school's placement advisor.
Okay.
And came back to me and said, MIT is the best place to be in to study aeronautical engineering.
Have you ever heard of MIT before?
Oh, sure.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Well, as I said, I'd lived in New England, Claremont, New Hampshire.
Okay.
That's where I applied.
Okay.
And was accepted and went on to.
So, kind of, I want to dive a little bit into that, like applying to MIT. MIT is a pretty prestigious college. Was it as simple as filling out an application, or was there more involvement in that?
Well, it's like
especially
any other
the aeronautical
school,
department.
It's like any other school. You write for the information, the forms, and you fill out. You do what they ask you to do. You fill out all the stuff and send it off to you, and then they look up your grades and maybe, I don't know, contact your teachers and whatever they do. MIT is really pretty good at choosing their students. In my fraternity, in 4 years, one person in my pledge class decided not to come back. He had good grades, but he just decided MIT wasn't good for him. It wasn't for him. The other one was a freshman in my senior year who just screwed up, just messed up. So of all of those people, you know, those are the only ones who didn't finish. Most people go in to MIT, go through the 4 years, or in the case of architecture, 5 years, and graduate.
So now you get a BS in aero engineering.
Yes.
But that wasn't enough. You decided to continue on with some more education?
Well, yeah. In those days, it was sample data systems were very big, you know, the little Laplace transforms. And my specialty was stability and control and handling qualities of airplanes. And so there's a lot of math involved. This is before before the computer-based stuff was available that made things so much easier.
Right.
So I went back and took some courses in that, math courses, automatic control courses.
And so this was astro engineering? Is that what that's called? Because I see that that you've got a degree in astro engineering. Kind of explain to our listeners what that is.
Well, my original degree was in aeronautical engineering, and that was in 1956. Between then and 1964, the space age dawned. And so the MIT changed the name of their department from aeronautical engineering to aeronautical and astronautical engineering.
I gotcha.
And that's the name of the degree. So I could care less about the astronomical astronomical.
So it was more of a marketing ploy from MIT.
Well, no, they did stuff about that.
Okay. So after MIT, you graduate from MIT, you're obviously out looking for a job. Where do you go after that?
Well, one of my mentors at MIT was Professor Miller, Rene Miller. He was a very big helicopter engineer. Mm-hmm. He got me jobs at Command in Hartford during the summer of my sophomore, junior year. And he got me a job at Piasecki near Philadelphia between my junior and senior years.
So this was like sort of an internship?
No, it was just a summer job.
Oh, okay.
Piasecki, at that time, shortly after I left, it was while I was there, became Boeing Vertol and still is.
I gotcha.
So having that helicopter orientation, I decided to fly to Hiller Helicopters, which mm-hmm. is in Palo Alto. Did go there. I didn't work on helicopters. I worked on the X-18 tilt wing test bed, which was a Kluge. It was a Chase YC-123 transport fuselage. Take the wing off, throw it away, put a rectangular wing with two YT-40 turbine engines with contra-rotating props on it that tilted.
Gotcha. And that's how you got your VTOL.
That's VTOL, yeah. And the thing actually did fly.
I think I've actually seen video of that thing flying. How well did it fly?
Not too well. Well, it wasn't intended to fly too well. The engines and the gearboxes were very unreliable. They used them on flying boats from the Bay Area to Hawaii, and typically they'd fail.
Now this was a turbine prop or actually turbine?
It was a turboprop.
Okay. Gear reduction down to the...
It had two compressor spools driving a single prop. Yeah, I think it was two compressor spools going through a combining gearbox and then driving contra-rotating propellers, which was a big mess.
That's a pretty complicated system.
So
what was your part of that?
The performance, calculating performance and stability and control and handling qualities and making sure that, it was controllable.
If they had offered you a ride in it, would you have gone?
No, I don't think so. I would have, but I didn't want to have been on the same airport. I went back to Langley and took part in a spin tunnel testing of a model.
Okay.
In the spin tunnel model. They also had an outdoor facility where they flew by radio control a model that was tethered, and they flew it in a big circle. And they made the transitions where they tilted the wings down to speed up to forward flight, and then they would tilt the wing up and slow down to a hover flight. And they were all controlling it from a
remote control box, kind of a scenario.
Yeah. It was pretty elaborate.
So was it a fun time there, though? Were you having a good time doing this? Were you learning a lot?
Oh, yeah, I enjoyed it. I loved every minute of my career as an aeronautical engineer. I just, being able to work with airplanes, I would have done it for free if I could afford it.
So let's move on from there. You're at Hiller, and then you decide that you're going to continue your career someplace else?
Yeah, things kind of slowed down. The aero profession is like that. They have big programs,
that come and go all the time.
They come and go, and you can either stick it out through thick and thin, and I know people who have done that, or you can move on to the next project, which is going, and then the next project, which is the course that I chose. I went to Raytheon in Bedford, Mass., which is probably the least desirable job that I ever had. I didn't want to work on.
What was your role there then?
It was working on the Sparrow missile, which was already flying, and it was just kind of tweaking things. And I never, in the year that I was there, I never saw a Sparrow missile. This was 1961. Yeah.
Okay, so the Vietnam War, not quite spooling up yet. Korea maybe spooling down, kind of a thing.
Well, I think Korea was over by then.
Okay, and so you're working for a military company, and you're not happy, and so you decide, I got to get out of here.
Both at Hiller and at Raytheon, I had an educational deferment, or an occupational deferment, I should say, because of being an engineer. So I avoided the draft that way. Uncle Sam always knew where I was. He could have drafted me anytime he wanted to, but he decided...
But you were doing more better stuff.
He'd leave me where I was, yeah.
Yeah.
The job at Raytheon really didn't suit me, so that was when I decided to go back to get my master's. And I must say that in hindsight, I got very little use out of the stuff that I used that I learned during the master's. And if I had to do over again, I'd probably go for an MBA rather than the aero master's. because I think it would have done me more good marketing the S-22, the S-20, you know, getting that to market. Which,
okay, and that's your airplane design, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. Let's continue on with the career. You're on the East Coast.
Yeah, yes.
And then you make a hop over to the West Coast?
Well, I worked for while I was getting my degree, I worked at the MIT Instrumentation Lab. I worked for the Institute for Naval Studies in Cambridge, which did operational research for the Navy.
Okay.
You know, how to fly search patterns, how many airplanes fit on a carrier. Is VTOL a big deal or not? And also I worked with a Surface Technology Corporation, which is a support organization for the new Transportation Research Center, which was just created in Cambridge. So that took me up until about 1968, 69. I decided I'd got a little bit ahead, so I decided it was time to design an airplane.
I got you. And what was the aviation field at this time? Was it moving fast, or had things slowed down a little bit?
Well, no, things were going pretty good, going along. It wasn't until the early 70s that they really slowed down, I think, as I recall. It's just that I decided I had joined EA by that time and had been a member for several years, and I was kind of immersed in that and saw what was possible. And to tell the truth, I didn't really approve of much of the airplanes that were being built. You know, some of the rag and tube airplanes that were built.
Okay.
They're just obsolete, you know. They're just from the 30s or even 20s. And that I could see that the future was the all-metal airplane. That's the course I took, and that's the gospel that I preached at that time. When I rented a shop in Belmont, Mass., and set about designing the S-10.
The S-10.
The S stands for specification.
Okay.
And the 1 stands for the first specification. And the 0 stands for the prototype. Okay.
I gotcha.
And the S-10 was a VW-powered airplane that was powered by had a geared-down propeller. Let the propeller spin at a slower speed than the engine.
For efficiency?
Which gives a lot more thrust. Okay. If you can turn the prop smaller and make it bigger, you get a lot more thrust out of it.
You're in the middle of this designing the S-10. And where did you come up with the specifications for? What inspired those specifications?
Well, it was to take what was possible engineering-wise and what the engine gave me and what the gearing down gave me as a bonus. And I actually built I had a VW engine.
Okay.
I built a rig that let me build the belted gearing down process with a propeller, and it was in the backyard of my shop, and the neighbors didn't like it, but it didn't last very long. But
neighbors that don't like airplane noise, imagine
but,
that.
Yeah, but it was just too hard to make it reliable, and a little bit of research showed why the torque impulses of a reciprocating engine can be as much as 10 times up and down as the steady state torque.
Okay.
So there's your you know.
You've got these pulses.
Yeah,
it was energy pulses.
Shearing, shearing keyways and everything else in between there.
So how do you dampen that out then?
Well, a flywheel, I suppose.
Okay.
But I decided it was more than I wanted to mess with, so I moved on from the S-10. The S-10 had the engine mounted under the occupants who were seated 2 seats side by side, and then the drive shaft went up the front. It was a pretty compact airplane, but I decided that it was just too complex for a first design, and I'd better stick with something a little bit more conventional.
So did you ever get to a stage where you actually had a mock-up of the S-10? Was it something that you actually had the wings built or the fuselage built?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I had a mock-up of the cockpit and engine under installation that just gave me the geometry of how things fit together.
So you didn't ever pound ribs out and actually build a wing?
No, I never built any.
Did you do any aerodynamic testing on the model or anything along those lines, or was it all just math at this point?
It was all just analytical stuff, theoretical stuff.
What was going to be the weight of the aircraft when you were done?
Oh, geez, I don't know. It would have been about under 1,000 pounds. I don't recall. Probably about 900 pounds.
And you were estimating an 80-horsepower Volkswagen engine? Is that what you're
estimating? No, it wasn't. It was more like 60 horsepower.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And that was based off the Volkswagen engine?
Yes.
The four-cylinder air-cooled? Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So you weren't cutting a Volkswagen engine in half like a lot?
No.
Okay.
No.
Your 60 horsepower, do you think that today, with the engines today, that you might have been a little bit more successful in that design, given the lightweight jammers?
Well, there have been two-seat airplanes built with VW engines.
Okay.
I don't know how good their performance is, but there have been such things built.
Well, we had Arnold in here a few weeks ago, Arnold Ebnetter, and he originally designed the E1 for a Continental and then ended up going with a Jabiru 80 horsepower because of the weight versus horsepower that he had with it. And that took him quite some time. So I guess what I'm asking you is, if you had an engine like the Jabiru or the Rotax, do you think that the S10 would have been something that you would have kept on pursuing?
Well, the Rotax probably would have been good, or a Continental 0200. I actually had an 0200 at the time. I was building a Peel Emerald. It was an all-wood French design.
Yep.
But I quit that to do the my own designs.
Okay, so you abandon the S-10, but you don't abandon a dream of building an airplane. You just kind of put it on the shelf.
Well, I put it on hold and decided to go with something that was more more doable and more concert with my resources. You know, I didn't have all the money in the world. I didn't have all the time in the world. So I had to come up with an airplane in 2 years.
Bob, you're not telling me something that we all haven't struggled with, right?
So that's what I did. And as I said, I had the shop in Belmont, Mass.
Okay.
And I designed it as I went along and built it as I, you know, designed it.
Did you shelf the S10 and then decide that you were going to keep that design in your head and sort of bring that into the 20?
I abandoned the S10.
Altogether.
Not to say that it couldn't return as the S30 or something like that at some later date, but no, I just went with the S20 and then variations of that, the 21 and the 22.
Okay.
So I finished the S20, flew it. First flew in 1972.
Now, was that in the East Coast still?
Still in Belmont, yeah. It started out at Hanscom Air Force Base.
Okay, so you hadn't moved out to the West Coast yet you finished the S-20.
And then flew off the remaining of the hours at Tumac in Tewksbury, which is a suburb of Boston.
Okay.
Several fellow members of Chapter 106 helped me fly those hours.
Okay.
Between a lot of us, we got them flown off by Oshkosh that year, and so I flew from Boston to Oshkosh.
Okay.
And displayed the airplane. And Eileen Borkman commemorates that in her book.
Yeah, great book.
It is a great book.
Propeller Under the Bed.
That's right. That's the one, yeah. And then trailered the thing on to California. We were in the midst of the move to California in 72.
I see now.
My family, my wife, dog, and two kids, and airplane.
I was under the understanding, I apologize, I was under the understanding that the S-20 was designed on the West Coast, but you're telling me that no, it was designed East Coast in Massachusetts.
Yeah, well, a member of the Greater Boston Chapter 106.
And how long did it take you to design the S20?
About 2.5 years.
Okay, and the design criteria for that was?
To make an airplane that was easy to build, easy to fly, that was safe, that had halfway decent performance, a climb rate of about 500 feet a minute or greater.
Now, this was square steel tube that you rivet the skin to?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
And you found that construction method to be both strong and simple to do?
Well, I chose that as a structure that holds its shape best under crash loads, as opposed to a monocoque structure of aluminum, which tends to disintegrate. I think Mooney does the same thing. I think they have a steel tube fuselage.
They do.
Cockpit area.
Yep.
Yeah, for the same reason. And then, and plus it's also easier to analyze the truss, as you probably know.
And so you did all the analytical stuff for the S20.
Yes, yeah.
And kind of bring our listeners through the process of you've analyzed this design. What's the next step? You're going to build a model and do wind tunnel tests, or are you just going to start building some structure and testing the spars?
Well, the profession has progressed to the point where a lot of this stuff can be done analytically. There's enough experience that you can design your airplane empirically based on what succeeded in the past and what didn't succeed. Okay. Plus there are textbooks, structural books that give strength of materials and column loading and all that stuff. Although in the case of the S20, I did make up sections of the spar caps and tested them in compression at MIT.
And what were the spar caps made out of? How were those constructed?
Aluminum. They were made out of 0.62 aluminum sheet bent in L shapes and then nested together.
2024 or 6061?
2024 T3.
Okay.
Yeah, there's no 6061. Well, there's a couple of pieces in it.
But not structural.
Well, as a matter of fact, there are two pieces of 6061 T6 on the airplane. They're the spar caps of the center section.
Okay. And why 6061 when everything else is 2024?
Because it's what was available. And what fit? What was the right size? Yeah. So I did test the spar caps and compression. To make sure they weren't going to buckle in.
Full length or just a section of it?
Just a couple of sections.
Okay, and then you can through math.
Yeah.
Sort of calculate that out.
Yeah, there's plenty of textbooks that tell how to design. Stuff like that.
You've actually flew the aircraft before bringing it to Oshkosh, or did you fly it to Oshkosh?
Well, then as now, you had to fly it off a certain number of hours. I don't think it was 75 hours. I think it was a little bit less than that. It might have been 75 hours.
It's currently 40.
Is that what it is?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And they might give you 20 if you use a certified engine, but currently it's 40.
Okay. Well, it was a significant number of hours, and right. There were things that needed to be changed and fixed.
What did you discover during that flight time, that early experimental flight time? What kind of things did you change? Did you have to enlarge any surfaces? Did you have to shrink any surfaces, add trim tabs?
No, I'll tell you, the most distinctive thing was that the thing suffered from aileron snatch.
Explain that.
Which is a case where you move the aileron slightly in one direction and they want to go all the way. But they're fine around zero.
Do you know why that happens?
I'll get to that. but one of my professors at MIT suggested a fix for that. He put wedges on the trailing edge about a foot long on each aileron that kind of...
Vertical edges or horizontal wedges?
They're span-wise, but they're about an inch and a half in the longitudinal direction, about half an inch high. And that cured it.
Okay.
Some World War II airplanes experienced this. They were always trying to get greater roll performance in World War II airplanes, because that was a measure of how good you were in a dogfight. Sometimes they overdid it. But it wasn't until just a couple of years ago that I was looking online, and none other than Richard Van Grunsven had an article saying, some of us don't pay too much attention to getting the trailing edge angle of our ailerons as accurate as they should be. And it results in the, he didn't call it aileron snatch, but it was.
I've seen guys actually change the performance of their aircraft just by pinching down the ailerons and the trailing edge.
Yeah. Well, that was what was involved here. But I lived with it and cured it with the wedges until I, and as I, you know, over the years as I skinned and reskinned the control surfaces, sometimes it was better, sometimes worse. When I first built the airplane, I skinned the control surfaces with the 012 2024 T3.
Okay.
You can't get that anymore. 016 is the minimum now. So I found this at a Boston salvage yard, enough to do the elevators and the ailerons. And it was, you know, it was strong enough for the flight loads, but it didn't hold up to service. You know, people...
Fatigue type stuff?
No, it was just, you know, you'd
touch hangar rash type of thing.
People just touch it and it'd dent. So it was just too weak. So I went to 016.
So now does that wedge that you're talking about, is that still on the aircraft today?
No, it's not there anymore.
Okay.
Don't need it anymore.
How did you solve that?
Well, it was just a better control of the trailing edge radius.
I gotcha. Sharper edge or a little bit more of a rounded edge?
Well, it was a sharper edge, yeah.
Sharper edge.
Like you say, it was pinching it down.
You've got the S-20. Did you fly that to Oshkosh the first time?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
And then from Oshkosh, you pack up and move out to the California coast?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And what'd you do out in California?
Well, I joined my father in his building contracting business. He wanted to retire. He wanted me to kind of take over. He talked me into doing
running the family business, to speak.
And in the meantime, I would be pursuing the S-20 as plans, you know, that kind of stuff.
So was your father the only one out there? You have brothers, sisters that are out on the West Coast, or?
Well, he was in Oakland, where his sister lived, and so he moved out there to further his building contracting business.
Okay.
And lived there for many years. And he had a project in Sonoma, California, which is what he was working on when I joined him. So that's where I moved, Sonoma. Completed that project.
Were there any other family members involved in the business?
No, just my father.
Okay.
My father, yeah. And then he retired, and I got my own building contracting license and built houses under that license.
And so where is the S-20 all this time?
It's at an airport south of Sonoma. I can't remember.
So you're still flying it, though?
Oh, yeah, I was still flying it, yeah.
Okay. So it's not like it's collecting dust in a hangar. No. You're still flying it, doing improvements.
Well, I did. I flew it back to Oshkosh in 73.
From California?
From California, yeah.
How long did that take you?
So a couple of days. It was a very pleasant flight. It was, you know.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
I've flown my Sonics back twice.
Okay.
And, well, on a couple of company airplanes several times, so.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't understand why people don't like that flight. It's gorgeous. I can't recommend it highly enough.
Yeah.
You get to see the world. It's
Nebraska's
beautiful.
Nebraska's a pretty, very big state, I'll tell you that.
So is Montana.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
So you're doing improvements to the S-20. At what point did you decide that you were going to offer this up as something that others could build? Was that the goal originally?
Well, that was in mind from the start that I would offer plans and offer this as a little bit more modern airplane than some of the other stuff that was available.
Did you end up selling any plans? Has anybody else tried to build this?
Oh, yeah. I sold a number of plans, probably of the order of, 150, somewhere around there. Several people got pretty far. No one completed one, as far as I know.
So the one that you own is the only one that's flying, to your knowledge.
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
How far along did anybody get? Did you ever get any feedback from
them? Yeah, there was one fellow who wanted to put another engine on it. And I told him, no, I probably shouldn't have said that. But I said, no, you got to use a VW. I guess that's when he quit and when he gave up on it.
Decided to move on to something else.
I don't know what he did.
Okay, so California, you're building houses. You end up building houses for how many years?
Until 1980.
And then why did you quit?
I decided I didn't like building houses as much as I liked building airplanes.
And then you found yourself going where?
And so then I looked around to see what was available, and lo and behold, just across the Sierras in Reno, Learfan was going gangbusters instead.
So now do you have kids in tow at this point?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you moved the entire family out to Reno?
Yep, yeah.
How early in the process was the Learfan development when you got there?
It had flown. The investors had required that it be flown by December 31st, 1979, something like that, and it flew on December 42nd. But it was still, but that was just a prototype. It wasn't. Okay. It wasn't the production version that had to be certified. So that that was the.
Explain to our listeners what you're alluding to with the December 32nd flight. A little bit more.
Well, I said December 42nd.
42nd, sorry.
The investors cut the Learfan a little bit of slack. You know, it was supposed to be by the end of the year. They gave him a few extra weeks. They weren't going to.
They were so close that they could see the end of it.
Yeah, they were going to whack it. They weren't going to.
But the contract said that they had to have it flying by the end of the year.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Okay, so they end up doing this flight a week afterwards, and that flight was successful?
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, any flight that lands in one piece is successful.
How long was that flight? Do you remember?
No, I don't remember. But I wasn't there at the time.
Okay.
I didn't get there until after that. As a matter of fact, I was living in Concord, California at the time, having moved to the Bay Area after finishing up in Sonoma.
Okay.
So I was building in that area. And when I decided to leave a construction and found Learfan, I actually flew the S-20 up there from Concord and landed at Stead, which is where Learfan was.
So what was your role there when you got to Learfan?
It was in the Aero Group and soon to become an aerodynamics supervisor and pretty much stayed in that area. Had a small group of people doing the performance, stability, and control.
And what kind of difficulties did you have to overcome doing the Learfan? I mean, it's a pusher. Our listeners aren't familiar with it, it's a pusher airplane.
Yeah, all composite airplane, graphite, which is a big advance for the time. It had two PT-6 Pratt & Whitney engines driving just a combining gearbox, driving a four-bladed prop out the back. It was really pretty straightforward, overriding clutch in case one engine quit, which happened on one occasion. Engine out performance is great because it was symmetrical all the way.
Centerline thrust,
yeah.
What was the noise like inside the cabin, do you recall?
It wasn't too bad. I only flew in it a couple of times. And it hadn't been sandproofed at that time. It was still bare. But from a performance and a stability standpoint, it was great. It was pretty straightforward. Nothing unusual about it.
Now, is this the same aircraft that you're talking about here as what's hanging down at the Museum of Flight?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That exact aircraft?
Yeah, the Learfan Model 2100.
Okay. And that was a six-place? Because I thought originally it started off as a four-place aircraft.
I don't think it was ever that small.
Okay.
I don't recall the exact seating arrangements. It was at least a six. I think it was probably more like eight.
And the final configuration was eight?
Yeah. Well, including crew.
Including crew.
Yeah. But don't hold me to that. the biggest problem was the reliability, demonstrating the reliability of the propulsion system.
Okay.
Plus demonstrating that the graphite construction was sound and consistent, and that met the limit loads that were applied during tests, and that was the rub, and it wasn't helped by the FAA kind of dragged his feet on a lot of this stuff. They weren't too.
Was that because of the composite construction that they weren't familiar with, or do you think it was?
Well, I'm thinking in terms of the propulsion system itself.
You guys are starting to have problems with the propulsion system and getting that certified. But your end had nothing to do with the propulsion. It was more of the aerodynamics of it.
Yeah, right.
And what were the problems that you were overcoming with aerodynamics? What were the things that you had to solve?
Nothing major.
Really?
Nothing major. It was a good performing airplane.
Who was the original designer of it?
Well, several people. Bill Lear was the
founder. Came up with the concept.
A fellow by the name of Ian Gillespie. No, I'm sorry, Ian Gilchrist.
Okay.
Designed a propeller and the propulsion system, pretty much.
Was he with the program throughout, or did he end up leaving halfway through?
No, he stuck it out pretty much. Yeah.
And was it Lear? Was he there the entire program?
No, Bill Lear died in about 1978 or 79, sometime around there.
While this was still under development?
Yeah, yeah, before I got there, but shortly before. And his wife continued the project, Moya Lear. She kept it going. Of course, she wasn't as dynamic a person as Bill. I mean, you couldn't say no to Bill.
Who were the major investors, do you recall? Was it government backing, or was it more individual backing along those lines?
Well, toward the end, the government of Ireland, Northern Ireland, was the primary investor.
Was this before or after DeLorean?
I think it was before, but they were going to move this to be built in Northern Ireland.
I had never heard that before, that Ireland
never got that far. But individual investors were backing the thing.
So was the original concept always a passenger carrying business jet, or what was the original concept for the Lear itself, and what did it morph into?
Well, the original concept was a composite structured turboprop airplane
for the business class, or
for
general aviation, for business class.
For business, yeah, sure.
Okay.
Bill Lear by that time had already left Learjet.
Okay.
As you know, he pioneered the biz jet genre, but he'd left that. That was in Wichita. He was looking for something else to do, and
finds himself out at Stead and doing.
Came upon this, yes, and just bit off more than he could chew, and more than his successors and heirs could chew. But it was a good try, and I enjoyed it. I saw construction of a water tunnel model. Have you ever heard of that?
I have not.
You build a a model of the airplane, you plummet with a colored dye coming out of strategic spots, piped in through the tail and coming out wherever you want it to be. You put it in this water tunnel, blow the water past the model.
So you get sort of a laminar flow of water going
and
by.
And then you see where the dye goes, and you run it up in an angle of attack or in yaw, see where the
And the water the behaves goes. Just like air? It's still a fluid at that point? It's just fluid?
Yeah, within limitations, yes.
Okay,
yes.
So there are limits.
Yeah. It's very spectacular because of all the colorful dye. Yeah. In fact, I still have that model.
That's incredible.
In my cabinet in my living room.
So kind of wind us down now with Lear. Lear sort of starts to falter. And how long do you ride out Lear?
Well, Lear went bust. They went bankrupt.
While you were working there?
Yeah, while I was working there. So they, that was the end of it. So we're all out of a job.
How did they, did you just like show up one day and there was padlocks on the door?
Well, it wasn't quite that dramatic, but we could see it coming. And so they just announced, okay, just leave your stuff and don't,
Did they still owe you a paycheck or did they pay everybody
They
off?
Eventually paid everybody.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so after Lear, you find yourself doing what?
Looking for a job. And I found one in the L.A. area working on the B-2 program. This is the stealth bomber program.
Great. Yeah.
And that was a good job. It was interesting work. It was a very complex airplane. Again, I was working on the handling qualities and pilot evaluation.
And the S-20 follows you back to L.A. now?
Yes, yeah.
Where are you keeping it in L.A.?
I kept it at Brackett Field.
Okay.
Out, it's a little bit, I think it's in Orange County, but it's out east a bit. So I kept that there.
What was it flying the S-20 around the L.A. airspace? Was it complicated? Was it difficult? Or did you manage
to... I didn't like it because it was so crowded, not only with airliners, but with small... stuff too. There was, just a lot of traffic. So eventually I quit flying it in LA and stored it for a while.
You're in LA, you're flying around complicated airspace, you're working on an incredible project, B-2, which has got to be interesting to you. How long do you stay with that program and where do you find yourself after that?
Well, I stayed there from 85 to 92. By that time, the B-2 had flown successfully. It was well into a successful flight test program. Was doing everything it was supposed to do. And my part of it was kind of winding down. And so that's when I started looking around for another job and found job at Gulfstream in Savannah.
So you end up going to Savannah and working for Gulfstream doing what?
Performance and stability control. Later, I was a project program manager for the flight sciences aspect of it. And that's the loads and performance and that kind of stuff. Later, I went to flight test documented wrote up the reports that documented the performance that showed how it met the FAA regulations.
So are you keeping involved with the EAA all this time, or are you sort of falling out of favor with the EAA and come back years later?
Well, I wasn't, I wasn't active in the EAA in Savannah at that time until after I retired and decided to restore the S-20. I did rejoin an EAA chapter then, chapter 330.
And that was the first chapter you had joined since leaving the East Coast there from in Boston, Darwin, Massachusetts?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then you're at Savannah. You're working hard in Savannah, Georgia, for Gulfstream. And how long you end up staying there?
From 92 to 99 when I retired. Reached the age of 65 and retired. And by that time, the G5 program had pretty much completed. It had been certified, and we'd done some secondary certification of an expanded CG envelope.
Okay.
And so, you know, it was done.
And you were ready to retire.
And I was ready to retire, yeah. Try something new.
So let's get back to the S-20. The S-20 follows you out to Savannah, Georgia.
In my garage.
In your garage. Never flies out in Savannah?
Not until 2009.
Not until 2009. So you take a restoration project on at that point.
Yeah, 2008, 2009.
And you decide to restore it. And did you make any significant changes to the design at this point, or were you pretty happy with where it was at?
Yeah, I made a lot of changes. I put a full cowling on the engine. Didn't have that before.
Okay.
I put a canopy on it. Didn't have that before. I put fiberglass wingtips on. Put a starter generator.
So now it's got an electrical system.
Yeah. It's got GPS. It's got everything that have to have.
All the whiz bang.
Yeah.
ADS-B out. All that fun stuff.
Oh, no, I didn't have that. But
I'm hoping you put a couple dual Skyview 10-inch screens in there, right?
No, afraid not.
Afraid not.
It's all round dials, yeah.
I can only hope.
Yeah.
All right, so you refly it again in 2008.
2009, yeah.
2009.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. 2009, it reflies. You do this flight first? I mean, you do the flight again?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And are you happy with it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And is that the way it sits now? Same way it was then?
Pretty much, sure, yeah.
Pretty much.
The biggest change was the canopy.
Okay.
Which, and the engine had 1,915 cc's displacement, which is bigger than I had before. I think it was 1,800, something like that before. So it's faster at a lower engine RPM. You can open the canopy in flight. I took it up to 120 miles an hour. I put the placard on 100.
Okay. Now, was this something that you had to design into the canopy design itself?
Sure, yeah.
How did you tackle that? What were you looking at?
Well, I made an estimate of what I considered to be rational loads on the canopy.
Okay.
And then designed to that.
And this is a plexiglass with aluminum frame? Or
no, it's a steel tube frame.
Okay.
A pretty simple frame that's supported at three points. Two in the front and one in the back on the center line.
Okay.
And that's where it slides. And then the plexiglass canopy is attached to the frame by enough screws to transmit the loads from the plexiglass to the steel frame, without overstressing anything.
Okay.
And these were estimated loads, but they must have been somewhere near right because it works good. It is held together pretty well. Yeah.
So now, do you end up picking up speed or losing speed by putting the canopy on?
Oh, picked up speed, yeah. Cruise speed went from 90 to 100.
But that was with the engine, too.
Which was a pretty small change, but the engine RPM went from 3,300 to 3,000. So, in other words, if I'd done 3,300 RPM with the new airplane, the new engine, I would have been at 120 miles an hour, somewhere around there, 115.
Bob, that is incredible.
Yeah, and it's about as clean as it can get, really, reasonably.
And if I may say so, it's a good-looking airplane for the type of construction it's got. It's got a really good classic look to it. So
yeah, well, thank you. I think
there's some pretty ugly airplanes out there, but
yeah.
It's not one of them.
Yeah.
All right, so tell me how you ended up out in Seattle area, because you're in Savannah, Georgia. You've never even really put roots in Seattle area, and now all of a sudden here you are in front of me in Snohomish.
Well, there I am living in Savannah, Georgia. I've lived there 20 years. That's longer than I've ever lived any place in my life. much of it after having retired. I'm all by myself. Dawns on me that my son in Seattle, I need to come out. Had you
ever been to Seattle before?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I've been here.
So you knew how beautiful it was around here, and wasn't a big arm twist to come out.
No, I've been here before.
Okay. And so you pack up everything, come out here, and you bring the S-20. How'd you get the S-20 out here?
I took the wings off and put it in the back of it. U-Haul Penske trailer, and along with the rest of my belongings.
And haul out to Seattle, and where's the first place you find yourself here in Seattle?
Well, I had planned ahead about where I was going to keep it, and it turned out to be Payne. So I'd arranged for hangar space there at Payne. And so that's where I dumped it off.
Put the wings back on. Had you ever been to the Boeing plant at Payne Field before?
No.
What, did you find that pretty incredible to see airplanes that size?
Everything about that Boeing operation is pretty incredible. But no, I hadn't. I didn't take the tour until several years later.
So, where's the aircraft now?
It's at the Port Townsend Aero Museum.
So, if you want to go see the S-20,
you got to go to the Olympic Peninsula in Port Townsend.
And there it is on display.
Well, I'm not sure if it's on display or not. It was for a while.
Did they ever fly it?
Yeah, they did fly it.
Okay.
Shortly after I donated, they sent me a newsletter that showed a picture of the S-22 on the front page with a young lady at the controls saying she's all smiles after her first flight, the McDonnell S-22.
That's great.
I was kind of surprised that they let him fly it, but the director of the museum had flown it.
Are they taking good care of it?
And I hope so.
I guess we need to fly out there and take a look at it, don't we?
Check it out, yeah.
All right, it's a date. All right, I can't tell you how educational this has been, and I want to step a little bit more on the education, because I know you have a passion, and one of those passions that you have in aviation is safety. And I know that, unfortunately for you, you lost a hangar mate just a few years ago to a stall spin accident out here at Whidbey. And ever since then, you've sort of taken up this flag of trying to teach people not only better practices, but what you need to do.
It began before then, David. It began with informal sense with the EA's contest for ways to make airplanes safer. And it seemed unreasonable that we kept killing ourselves the same ways over and over and over again. And why don't we fix it? And one of those ways is the stall spin accident in a quartering tailwind base to final turn, where the airplane, has a propensity to spin, and it does. The second one is what happens when you fly into IFR conditions. They say that you're good for about 2 minutes, and then you lose control because of the vertigo that you experience. Shortly after I got my pilot's license in 1958, I took some classes at San Jose State University in a link trainer, instrument training, but taught me how to believe the instruments and how to scan them and disregard the feelings of my, vertigo, and just rely on the instruments. And I would try that from time to time as I flew, and think I got good enough so that if it ever happened that I did get in instrument conditions, I could probably make a U-turn and get out of them.
And is this something that you would recommend to all pilots?
Well, and this was part of the submission that I made to the EAA in this in their contest for ways to improve safety. Part two was making airplanes less apt to snap in at stall. A lot of airplanes in either accelerated stalls will tend to roll uncontrollably, and you just have to catch them. Look at the nose down, and you know.
So, do you think this is more of a pilot error issue, or do you think it's more of a aircraft designer issue, or maybe a little bit of both?
No, it's strictly an airplane design issue. Well, in my estimation, accidents have three factors: the pilot, the plane, and the external circumstance, whether it's, you know, wind or distractions or whatever it is. But in this case, in the case of the stall spin, it's the plane primarily. Of course, it's an intention on the part of the pilot.
And what do designers need to do to rectify this?
They need to employ available resources like stall, like vortex generators ahead of the ailerons to keep the outer wing flying so that the outer wing, one outer wing doesn't stall in before the other and make you roll.
So where does this come in as far as the flight envelope? Where is a pilot most vulnerable to this?
Well, the classic one is where he's on base. He has a quartering tailwind. He turns on to final.
Are we talking a slight breeze, or are we talking a significant wind as far as the quartering tailwind? Doesn't matter.
Doesn't have to be great, but what happens is that he's low to the ground. He's got this tailwind on base that's pushing him across the ground. He looks down at the ground. He says, "That going past pretty fast. I better slow down." Hauls back on the stick. He then turns on the final. He finds that the tailwind has pushed him past the runway. He honks it around to get back on the runway, center line, mm-hmm. and bam. That's when the characteristic of the airplane bites him.
So what characteristic of the airplane would you like to see at that point?
I'd like to see the ailerons remain effective into the stall. And that can be accomplished by simply putting vortex generators on. It can also be, solve the problem by restricting the up elevator travel that prevents you from getting real far into the stall. There's also other devices like leading edge stall strips that provoke a stall in the inboard part of the wing, and while the outer part is still flying. Now, these are all things that they're known. They're just not applied, and they should be applied. They ought to be applied. That was the basis for my submission to EAA when my hangar mate had his fatal accident on Whidbey at Langley. I was really appalled, David, that an RV-8A is supposed to be the gold standard for airplanes, for home-built airplanes. How could this airplane have this characteristic? And I know Van is very safety conscious. He has people, doing all sorts of stuff to make sure that his planes are flown safely and blah, blah.
If you've seen the testing that they do, you would be appreciative of it.
But in this case, it was a combination of the airplane's characteristic. My hangar mate had installed a camera system for the first time. I think he was just a little bit distracted by that, by its operation. He had the external condition of the tailwind on base. And it was just a kind of confluence of circumstances that if the airplane had been more properly prepared, it probably would not have happened.
Well, I hope that we can prevent that kind of stuff in the future. And I can tell by the passion in your voice that it's something that you will continue to preach and give advice. I would imagine if anybody wanted to talk to you about it.
Well, I did. As a result of that, I did take half of my submission to the EA contest. I took the stall spin half and developed a program that I called Safe Stall. And this involved doing a survey of an experimental aircraft's current characteristics, whether it's where it's deficient, what can be done, and then doing it, and then testing it, and seeing it, and then when it the airplane with its vortex generators or stall strips or whatever it meets the standards that are set, it gets a badge that says Safe Stall.
Well, Bob, it's been an absolute pleasure talking with you this evening, and I can tell you that it was an education. I hope that some of our listeners heed your warnings about safety, and I hope that they enjoyed hearing about the incredible career that you've had in aviation, and that maybe it inspires a few to go ahead and seek that kind of a career, because it can still happen today. It's an incredible field to be in, and I think you would agree with me.
Yes, absolutely. I do agree. Things that were interesting and cutting edge when I was starting out, are there's new stuff now. Yeah. And it's just as exciting, and it's just as satisfying.
Well, going forward, I think we've got a pretty exciting future for aviation.
I agree with that. I agree.
Thanks again for coming down to the Flabby Bottom Flying Club Studios, and I look forward to going up to Port Townsend to see your airplane with you.
Okay.
And now some chapter news. This month's meeting will be held June 8th, starting at 7 p.m. This meeting again will be a hybrid that up to 20 members will be allowed to attend in person at Harvey Field, Hangar 15. These members must pre-register with President Jim McGooey well before the meeting. I pray this trend continues and we can get back to fully attending meetings soon. I would encourage everyone to keep updated by going to the chapter website and look at the chapter newsletter and social media for the Zoom link. The presentation this month will be from kit plane enthusiast Mark Penn Stadler. I mean this literally, as his YouTube channel is Kit Plane Enthusiast. Mark will talk about all the various airplanes he has owned and built over the past 10 years, including his latest airplane, a Zenith CH-750. Make sure you watch a few of his videos before the meeting so that you have some background for questions after his presentation. AirVenture 2021, or better known as Oshkosh, will offer a new and safer way to arrive at the event called Express Arrival. Express Arrival, in partnership with Airbus, is exclusively available to U.S. members who have valid EAA memberships through at least July 31st, 2021. Shipping is free of charge, but you must order your passes by June 15th, 2021 to take advantage of Express Arrival. And finally, I would like to pay my respects to a legend in the aerospace family, Michael Collins. After graduating from the United States Military Academy in 1952, Michael joined the U.S. Air Force, eventually flying one of my favorite military jets, the North American F-86 Sabre. Entering the space program in NASA, as you may know, Mr. Collins was once considered the loneliest man not on Earth, as he orbited the command module while Armstrong and Aldrin landed on the moon. Mr. Collins retired from active duty in 1970, but went on to serve in the reserves until 1982, finally retiring as Major General. For a short period, he was Assistant Secretary of State and even Director of the National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. from 1971 to 1978. Mr. Collins was the definition of an accomplished life. His enthusiasm for aviation and aerospace only came second to his family. The general never understood the fame that was bestowed upon him, but he knew it was his duty to use that fame to promote goodwill around the globe on behalf of his country. I was lucky enough to see him speak on several occasions, and during his stories of sacrifice and duty, He always made it a point to recognize the people who worked hard in the background of the space program. Michael Collins was a great American, and he will be missed. It is this man's opinion that we could use many more like Michael Collins today. That wraps it up for this month's podcast. I hope you enjoyed hearing from our guest, Bob McDonald. Spread the word about the Chapter 84 podcast to your friends. It's available for download on most popular apps, including Spotify, Apple, and Google. Be sure to follow EA Chapter 84 on social media apps like Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And once again, I'd like to thank Adam Schultz for his hard work on the podcast music. Until next time, this has been your host, David Weber, and remember to stay off the brakes, keep moving forward.